I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Education and General Government Committee. This is technically not our first meeting. We had our joint committee hearing last week, which I thought was a good stage setter for some of the issues that we'll be chewing on in the coming months. I know that to my committee, I'll spare you the introductions and what we did last summer drill that most of us went through in our committees last week. But I do want to say that I personally am very honored to be here with experienced members, not only of this committee, but in the previous lives, Senator Bonamici, an activist in education, and all of you have your own experience depths here. So have patience with me. This is my first time as chairing this committee, and hopefully I can learn from your experience as we move on. What we will do today after we adopt rules will be go through an organizational, informational meeting, I should say, and then we will hold a hearing and work session on Senate Bills 41 and 69. So I do want to say that to the committee that this is a two-day-per-week committee. If we went to 3 days, the third day would be Friday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and my hope is that if we meet on time and that we work diligently, we'll be able to at least minimize the number of times we have to meet on those Fridays. So our work is cut out for us because the House is meeting 3 days a week, the House Education Committee. So before we go any further, let's look at the committee rules.
Any Mr. questions? Chair, if you'd like, I can review or answer any questions.
Sure.
Pretty pro forma for the committees. They're standard. Is there any questions?
Pretty standard.
To an organizational meeting.
Yeah. So I will open up the organizational meeting.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the proposed committee rules dated 1/15/09.
All right. Senator Cruz moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 1/15/09. Discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excuse
me. Aye. Motion passes. Rules are adopted. Now open the informational meeting. We have an overview of legislative priorities from the State Board of Education. And with Duncan Wise, Chair, and Susan Castillo, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, and the overview of legislative priorities from the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, Pam Prius, the Commissioner. Do you all want to come up together one at a time, or perhaps it may be it may make more sense for you all three to be up at the same time so that we can have some back and forth?
There
we go. Mr. Wise, you want to begin?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Duncan Wise. I serve as the chair of the State Board of Education. I want to thank you for inviting us to participate in your first meeting today and give you an overview of what we're doing. We see ourselves as a resource for you. We implement your laws and under your direction. And so as the session goes on, we would welcome the opportunity to present our ideas to you and seek your guidance as we do our work on behalf of children in Oregon. The State Board does have responsibilities over the K-12 policies and the community colleges, so I'm really delighted to have the state superintendent and the commissioner of the community colleges. I will tell you at the outset, we have great working relationships with both. In the case of our superintendent, she is elected, of course, and the board is appointed by the governor and approved by the Senate. And in some states, that is a very awkward and difficult relationship, as one might imagine. I will tell you, in our case, we are very much aligned on our vision and the staff, including the superintendent. The superintendent is excellent, and the staff that work for her are just incredibly supportive of the board, and we have great working relationships. So, again, in. I think we're very lucky as a state to be in that position. The commissioner is hired by the board, but also has a number of responsibilities to the governor. And again, I think we've got great relationships there as well as with the Board of Higher Education. So we are feeling very good about the work we're doing and our relationships with the organizations we oversee and partner with. About the board, just briefly. It is, from my perspective at least, a wonderful board. We are diverse in a number of ways. Geographically, two members from east of the mountains, one from the coast, four on the I-5 corridor. We've got diverse in terms of backgrounds, diverse. We have a Native American, a Hispanic, and an African American, three women, four men, and a very wide variety of life experiences that we bring to this work. We meet monthly for a day and a half and find a lot of time between meetings that we need to work to do our responsibilities. And again, we take them very seriously. Our vision. We are committed to the idea that all students should have the opportunity to learn and to go as far as they possibly can go in their learning in Oregon. We obviously have responsibility for the first 14 years, up to 14 years of education, and we want that experience to be a very satisfying one for every student. Our vision is for customized learning, personal plan and profile for every student, where they can go as far and as they want to go, as fast as they want to go, all anchored on common standards for learning in terms of the core academic skills, but with a wide variety of opportunities for how they learn and how they proceed in their experiences. We do subscribe to the goals that I know you heard about last week, many of you have been involved in helping shape the 40-40 vision. We do believe that we are in a period of time where we need to advance the levels of education for all Oregonians. If you think about the period we're in historically, we think we're at a moment in time where we need to adjust the education platform to accelerate learning and to create outcomes where more students have higher levels of learning than ever before. This is not unlike the time we experienced roughly in the 50s when we invented the community college system, when we ramped up the K-12 system and expanded higher education. At that time, we expanded the number of students who graduate from high school from roughly 50% to about 80%, and we expanded the levels of education in higher education from about 10% to around 30%. What we're saying now is we need to take another leap. We've been pretty flat in that period since then. It matched the economy and the world we lived in back in the 50s, and it matched it fairly well. But in the 21st century, we believe more students need to be more highly educated than ever before, and we can certainly do this if we choose to. And with your support and with a common vision, we think we can take this to another level. Again, the goal, 40% with a higher ed degree or more, and we'd expect many of those with a higher ed degree to have professional degrees and beyond on higher education. Another 40% with a meaningful certificate beyond high school, and the other 10% with a strong high school diploma. So a challenging vision, especially in these times, but we think it can happen. But it will only happen if we make some major changes in direction and policy. And the three areas that we are focused on in terms of changing relate to curriculum and the standards and assessment system, relate to the data system and the budget system, and we're working on all three of those very diligently. Perhaps the most visible is around curriculum. We in Oregon have been on a path to creating high standards in our curriculum for the last couple decades or so, but in this last 2 to 3 years we've really ramped up that work in a number of areas. First, most notably, is the high school diploma, but at the same time we've been working on the diploma to create a high standards diploma. We've also been working very diligently to connect more clearly the connections between high school, community college, and the university system so that there's a clear, more common pathway in design so that students can move more seamlessly from one to the other. And there's a lot of great work under legislation that you adopted through the joint boards to connect our curriculum across the system to accelerate learning. The second piece is around the data systems. You've, again, with the support of the legislature, we've been working to create a common data system to help track students' progress across the education enterprise, and we hope in the future to be able to create an electronic profile for all students that they will hold with them throughout their education experience, and also a system that will give you better, more real-time information on the student outcomes. The third area that we feel is really important is the budget system. Again, I think you heard from James Sager last time about the work of the Joint Board Budgeting Committee. We are trying to look at the whole education budget as a continuum, pre-K through higher education, understand how we're investing at every stage along the continuum and the dollars that we're putting per student, and also understanding the outcomes at every part of the continuum so that we can understand the results we're getting. And if with your support and leadership through this committee and the Ways and Means Committee, we think we can create a different set of accountability and expectations through the budget system to really help drive the 40-40-20 goal. So three major elements that we're working on that drive all of our work. There are some specific policy issues that we're working on right now that you're likely to be, you'll be hearing about this session, which I want to highlight. The first is the new diploma. I think we passed out materials about the new diploma, and again, I'm sure the superintendent will touch on it as well. We are working very hard on it. We have created a diploma that expects all students to be able to read, write, apply math and speak at high levels upon graduation, and a set of assessment tools that will document that learning. We also have four other essential skills that we are not yet in place, but we anticipate putting in place in the years ahead. In addition, we've ramped up the requirements in math and science, again, with the expectations that students will be learning at levels when they graduate to enable them to go on to college or into a meaningful work with a high-quality job. We are creating a high-standard diploma for all students in Oregon with the expectation that will prepare them for college, work, and citizenship. Again, it becomes a critical platform for everything we're doing on the education continuum. We've had great support from the community college and the higher ed system in this work, and great support from employers. So very important piece of work. And again, last session, as we transitioned from the SIM and the CAM, we put this in place as a model that we think is going to be more workable for the future, but again, creating high standards and building off the work that's been going on in K-12 for some time. A second piece of work that we are involved in right now, which the commissioner will report in, is the career readiness certificates. We would like to have in place a set of certificates statewide that are available in the workforce system, in the employment department, in community colleges, and in high schools that document learning, the level of learning in reading and math as it applies to workplaces. And that's going to be a big priority that I know is in the governor's budget, and we want to be the first state in the West to really make this a prominent part of our workforce system. It really ties very nicely to everything else we're doing in education right now, but to have a common way of documenting learning that employers can understand that can tie to specific jobs is a very powerful assessment tool that we would like to put in place. I mentioned the education budgets and the need for looking at the whole continuum. As we look at the 40-40-20 goals, a number of areas are important. Well, of course, the Quality Education Commission work that I serve on the Quality Education Commission in K-12, I hope you've seen the document. Again, it's a good tool for you to use to understand how much money we're spending now in education, what the current level of funding will buy, and what your performance expectations can be at the current level, and then what additional dollars could buy in terms of additional performance and product in the K-12 system. Well, also, as you know, there's a Quality Commission in higher education occurring right now that's in development. On the higher ed front, I would say the key budget issue you need to think about, and again, this is something a mantra of mine, and the board I know is we're in concurrence in this, is an issue that may be sort of subtle, but it's terribly important. It's about the essential budget level. In both higher education and community college, the essential budget level is set with no expectation of enrollment growth. And if we're going to have the 40-40-20 goal, you want more education in higher education, we need to change that. Right now, budget policy in Oregon, it goes like this. If you're a high school senior and you commit a felony, you, in terms of state budget policy, are guaranteed a place in the correction system in Oregon. We expand with the essential budget with, if you will, the population in the penitentiary. It's built into the essential budget. If you graduate from high school without a felony, with a new high school diploma, and are ready to go to college or the community college, we don't entitle you a place in those systems. We don't expand the budget with enrollment in the essential budget. We think until we change that, we're setting those two systems in the wrong place at the beginning of the budget budget process. We need to find a way, as we increase the number of students going on into higher education, to pay for it. And so we would recommend an area to focus on this time is to really look at those formulas and to think about what is it going to take to really expand access to those systems and be where we want to be. A third area we're working on, I'm sure you'll hear quite a bit about, is online learning. We've had a lot of proposals in that area this in the last couple of years. We've had a lot of experience in hearing from the various schools who provide those services. We've had numerous hearings on the subject. And as you hear about these issues, we are preparing a report right now for you to help you educate you. We're more than happy to share with you all the what we have learned and some of the major policy issues. The staff has done a terrific job in this area, and again, we'd be more than happy to share our insights with you. So, in conclusion, the board is eager to help any way we can. Never hesitate to call me or my fellow board members on any of the issues that come before you. We'll give you our perspectives. We, in many ways, are like you. We're volunteers to this subject. We have a terrific staff. I know you'll be hearing from them throughout the session, and they're here to help. But if there at any point you'd like to hear from us directly, never hesitate to call. We're here to help. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. Wise?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan Castillo, and I'm the Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. I look forward very much to working with all of you this session. I have no doubt that this committee is going to be doing some great work to help the children of our state, and so we want to help you in any way that we can and look forward to the great work that we're going to do together. I am here today to talk a little bit about what ODE does, sort of at a high level. I'll just briefly touch on some of the major areas of work, talk a little bit more about the legislative priorities that you just heard Duncan talk about, and then just wanted to hear from you today about any thoughts or questions that you had that you wanted us to make sure that we keep on our radar for you this legislative session. I also wanted to acknowledge the very, very high regard and respect that I have for the role that each one of you plays in our state as legislators. As you know, I used to serve in the legislature, and I really have a very good appreciation for your work and the important work that you do for our state. And I also know that you're facing a very, very difficult session with the economic challenges that are before us. And so just want to thank you for the work that you're doing for our state. We did provide you with a binder. In the binder is information about ODE, about key contact folks throughout the agency, about lots of information about our schools in the state, the ODE bills that have been introduced this legislative session, and as Duncan mentioned, you also have the Quality Education Report. And one part of that report that I'm particularly excited about is one section that focuses on the best practices that are happening in our top performing schools around the state, the schools that are really making great progress on closing the academic achievement gap and really rethinking how they do their work and how they use time during the school day and how they use their resources in different ways to support students in their schools. And so I hope you'll take some time to take a look at that, and you'll see the common traits that those schools have, and we want to make those best practices happen, of course, in every school in Oregon, and it's really a great resource and great work by the Quality Education Commission. Well, as you know, ODE is charged with ensuring the success of all students in our schools. And in that work, of course, we partner with our State Board of Education, with the community colleges and higher education, definitely with our districts and our education partners throughout the state, with business leaders and community organizations in that work. And right now, the big focus of our work, as we partner with everyone, is the implementation of the Oregon Diploma Requirements and continuing to make progress on that very, very important work. Because when you first start talking about the diploma, you start thinking about high school, but it really is about alignment of the entire system starting in pre-K and really trying to help all of our children get on a higher path of knowledge and skill so that they can be prepared to earn this more rigorous high school diploma. So it really is about system change work and alignment work throughout our education system and better alignment with our other partners in the community colleges and higher education. And also our workforce part of our state as well. We still continue to very much hone in and focus and shine the light on the academic achievement gap. We've been making progress on that in our state, but we are not where we need to be, and we continue to shine the light on that and look at best practices and convene people around our state together on how we can make better progress and make better decisions about how we serve the needs of all children in our state. We continue to make progress in our state in early education, which is very important to help our children get a strong start. In this budget proposed by the governor, it looks like if we are successful, we will be able to continue to make more success in Head Start and early Head Start for the first time. And also my hope is that we continue to make progress on providing full-day kindergarten for more children in our state. We also very much know that we need to continue to focus our collective efforts on literacy. If children can't read, they can't learn, and we know that that is absolutely a gateway skill for everything, and so we continue to work on that, and that is a very important part of the new diploma requirements. We know that we must continue to work on delivering more for the state of Oregon with the resources that we have and to have more efficient and effective departments operations and more efficient and effective practices throughout our school districts, and we are making progress in that direction and are coming together around that and sharing best practices and making some progress there. And then, of course, continuing to work with you on delivering more accountability as an agency and throughout our education system, and we look forward to continue on working with you. I know last session we talked a lot about the performance measures, and I know we're going to be back having more of those conversations for all state agencies, and so we look forward to coming back to you and continuing to hone and refine that work so that we can deliver better results for our state. I want you to know that the Department of Education is staffed by amazing, talented, hardworking, innovative thinkers, and they stand ready to help you in your work this session. I stand ready to help you this session. We really want to be an asset and support for you in helping you with the important work that you're going to be doing. I'll just briefly touch on our department operations just real quickly. As you know, we implement the policies and the operations that are passed by the legislature, by our state board, and we oversee the state school fund distribution, our statewide assessments, the long list of federal programs. We are proudly the regulators of the education system. We take that work very seriously, and we are working with our school districts on how we better partner in that work so that we can create better alignment in how we do our regulatory work. We oversee the special schools of the School for the Deaf and School for the Blind, the programs for the children in our youth correction system, the early intervention, early childhood special education programs, the other special education programs, working in very strong partnership with our education service districts, and in that work, we provide services to children in our long-term care and treatment programs, in our hospital programs as well. We are looking forward to working with you on the agency's budget and, of course, the education budget in general. We know that you face some very, very difficult and challenging decisions as you work on the budget together, and I just ask that you do everything you can to protect the education budget and help us continue to provide what we need to provide for all students in our state. We are looking forward to getting some help for our assessment system. The costs there continue to grow, and we the governor has provided some help for us there. Hopefully you will find support for that as well. And then, of course, as I said earlier, we're looking forward to continuing to make some continued investments in early education, in Head Start and early Head Start. for our state. The legislative priorities, once again, need to continue to move forward on making as much progress as we possibly can on the diploma requirements, and hopefully we can have a deeper conversation about what that work entails, both at the state level and throughout the school districts. And we just look forward to continuing to work with you closely and hear your advice and comments to us as we move forward this legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Any questions for Superintendent Castillo? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this isn't a question so much as a comment, although I could say, do you agree at the end if you insist on it being a question, Mr. Chair. But I wanted to thank you for including the arts and second language in the diploma requirements. And I see that they're phased in. And really, it looks like until 2012 and 2014 won't be required. And I just encourage you to not back away from those. Students who study in the arts and participate in arts and music tend to be more creative, critical thinkers, oftentimes happier at school, and sometimes stay in school for those programs that are offered to them. And also, as someone who's been for a long time, many years, a proponent of second language learning, thank you also for having that included as well. I think we need to have second language learning at the elementary level, as any adult who has tried to learn a second language knows. It's much more difficult as an adult, and early language learning is something that I think will help all students. So thank you for having those in there. Please don't back away from those, and I will do everything I can to help with those issues as well. Thank you. Do you agree?
Yes. I mean, this on all aspects of the diploma, we've had incredible discussions, and Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I think we need to, and frankly, we're going to need to take a harder look at second language down the road. I mean, my personal concern is we don't have enough yet in second language, but which will bring me to a point I would like to make in all this. We have to very carefully craft the requirements with the capacity of the system in mind to serve. You know, when we put something for all students, we have to be very sensitive to what the capacity of the system is to provide it, which is where the budget and the diploma and these requirements come in. You know, we take a lot of care in doing that, because it's very easy to think everything is important, we need to do everything, and almost all these subjects are important, and the challenge is how to stage this. But what we hope is over time we'll be able to expand the knowledge and skills in a lot of different areas for Oregon students.
So will there be any policy bills that will be introduced that this committee should review with respect to the diplomacy requirements? I haven't seen anything.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe we have anything that we, at this point anyway, there may possibly be as the work continues to evolve, but I don't believe there is at this point.
And I think, Mr. Chair, that what I would say, the big challenge on the diploma is frankly tying to the budget, because as you know, two meetings ago, we proposed to delay the math essential skills for 2 years, and that was directly related to the governor's budget. And again, a lot of controversy around that, and we're going to have to make these judgments. But the timing and pacing of this is really dependent on the budget. And so as you do your work in the budget committees, we'll be watching very carefully and, again, making sure that we're calibrating.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things. You know, back to the language thing, it does speak to some distance ed possibilities as well, mm-hmm. obviously, so that connection is going to be probably really important for that sort of thing, especially for remote schools. I'm a little more encouraged looking at the diploma page now than I was 2 years ago. You have some asterisks there that I find encouraging. I'm assuming at some point there'll be more detail given to students as to what they could do, for example, other than just straight algebra to meet that requirement. And I also look, you have it in both science and algebra, and you're talking about lab experiences that could be out of the classroom. For example, some school is building a house and, you know, that sort of thing. So theoretically, you could get science and math kind of in the same sort of thing. So I guess what I'd be interested in, because my fear with saying they have to have algebra to graduate is going to discourage some kids. And so if they know they have other options that they're more related to the real world, hopefully we can keep them connected. So I'm assuming at some point in time we'll see some more detail as to what's intended with that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, the short answer is yes. But I guess what I would say is that as we continue to make progress on improving how we help children get to higher levels of math skill and knowledge, certainly there, you know, we really want to support our schools in being as innovative and creative as possible on how they help our children get there. And so we need to continue as a state to make progress on providing high quality professional development for our teachers and our schools to help them be able to deliver this more rigorous content of math and help them continue to gain skills on how they differentiate, how they deliver that instruction to children, depending on how they learn, and so that we can be successful in getting all kids to this higher level of math. We know when we're able to do that and we're able to reach children in different ways, we can get children to higher levels of knowledge and skill if we're able to help our teachers get the support and the time and work together on how we accomplish that. So our state just needs to move forward on how we better support our teachers and deliver the kind of instruction that our children need to help them be more successful in math. And we are making progress on that. We're, we have a lot of work to do there, but we have set a higher bar, and with that means more support for our schools to get all children there. And it is going to mean extra time for some children and maybe more after-school programs or doubling up on math hours or summer school programs, and that's why this goal of getting them to this higher level is sort of crashing up against the current challenge of what we have resource-wise to support this, because we know that we do need to provide more, not less, instructional time to get kids to this higher level of rigor.
I'm not arguing with the goal, I never have. I went through trigonometry when I was in high school. If you put one of those formulas on this piece of paper in front of me right now, I wouldn't have a clue as to how to do it, because it's been a few years. Mm-hmm. But the critical thinking aspect of it, that's absolutely essential.
Right.
I know that. I mean, I can mm-hmm. think that way, and I can't work the problem, but I can think that way.
Right.
So that's the important thing that we're able to transfer here. Frank, you probably could work that problem, but I could.
Mr. Chair, one additional comment, if I might, Mr. Chair, just to add to the superintendent's point. One of the pieces of the diploma, which I didn't touch on, there's much we could talk about it. We could spend all afternoon, but I want to highlight it since you raised it, the credit for proficiency model that we adopted. One of the unique features of the Oregon system that's been developed is that the student can demonstrate mm-hmm. proficiency to clear standards in any number of settings. The Business Education Compact has been going around the state demonstrating exactly the model you're talking about, Senator. And I think it's among the most exciting developments in the state. A lot of students learn best in application, no question about it, to your point. And the more we can find those tools and those opportunities, whether it's an apprenticeship program or, as you say, in any number of avenues, that's when you really lock in learning. And again, I think we've got a terrific model to develop. As the superintendent says, we just need the professional development and the support to make that happen.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First a comment and then a question, since we have both the chair and the superintendent here. I appreciate your comments, Senator Bonamici. Those veterans in the room, and I see who they are, I think remember the 2001 session in which I introduced a bill on behalf of Andy King, who was an 8th grade music student, asking that the fine arts be included as an equivalent for second language requirements for all the many reasons that you articulated in the science and research that shows the connection between success in other academic endeavors as well as social endeavors, and that we need to recognize those. So I really appreciate the board providing this mix, recognizing that they're in tandem, and that each particular skill is an, in of itself important, but allowing students the flexibility to grow in a way that makes them more not only excited about school, but also the impacts of it. So that's a real positive. The other is I would like to ask you, because this will be coming before us, if you both had reviewed the report of the Financial Literacy Task Force, of which we had a meeting a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, when you're talking about budget and everything else, this is because projections of revenue are down. It's a very complex situation. But one of the key elements behind it in our country has because borrowing on credit card has finally caught up with us.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last 3 years, for the first time since the Great Depression, Americans have been had a negative spending rate, which means we spend more than we earn each month. And eventually now the house of cards has fallen, and we can no longer sustain that. And we're trying to dig our way out of responsible fiscal management. And the task force has said that, above all, when we look at our students going into the real life to be really engaged, they have to really understand the implication of the dollar, what it means to them personally, because it does trickle through all our life if we mismanage money. And they have recommended that the best way to do that to get the Board of Education in the requirements, to each of our students that graduate understands, you know, the economic forces on a very personal level in terms of making financial decisions, is to make financial literacy, in fact, an essential skill. By doing so, the board then would be charged with making sure that we can demonstrate proficiency and be able to measure that for our students. And certainly in the academic areas in which you're emphasizing, that type of curricula can be incorporated into mathematics requirements, into science, but it needs to be focused on, there needs to be a measuring. And I would say the same thing with civics, with the social sciences, and English and language arts. You know, if there's a focus on using measurement of reading and writing, but also using civic examples to do that, we can achieve those goals. Just wondering from both the superintendent and the chair if you are supportive of financial literacy as an essential skill that should be woven into the curriculum for graduation requirements within the existing academic performance standards that you have established.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, the committee that you're just referring to presented its report to the board just this last week on Thursday, I believe?
Thursday, yes.
Yeah. And it was a great conversation, and the report is filled with great recommendations, and I think it it prompted a very, really good discussion by the board. You know, one board member made the point that right now there is nothing stopping any school board in the state from moving forward and requiring that for students in their district. And another another board member made the point that when we talk about what's happening with the economy right now, let's not forget that it's not just that people perhaps aren't as skilled in this area as they need to be, but it also has to do with really bad practices by financial institutions and banks and others, which, you know, has led to the current situation as well. And those people do have financial literacy skills. So I think it's more complicated than just, you know, than just the skill level in that area. Having said that, it is very, very important that our children have that skill. And I think as a state that we should be looking for opportunities to help them get that in our social studies standards, there are standards that do address this area in Oregon standards. But having a new part of the graduation requirements, I know civic engagement is one area in there that also could entail and have broad. A broad application for how we help our students with that. So I know it's something that the board's going to continue to talk about, and we will continue to work together on it with our schools, but I think it's really important work. I think the committee did great work and made some really good recommendations for our state.
So I might comment, Mr. Chair. Senator Metzger, first of all, again, thanks for asking for that task force. It was an excellent task force, and the report was terrific. They did present. What we committed to do was to bring it right back. I mean, we had a good discussion. The complication on financial literacy is the breadth of as you say, of the areas where it could come into the curriculum. It could come into math, it could come into social sciences and economics. And I guess my own person, this is just one board member, but I would really, if we're going to do it, I would make it an essential skill. I'm so glad you raised that as opposed to making it a class. I've talked to students who've been in the finance class, and that isn't the model. What we need to do, I think I've talked to some students about this in their own experiences, if you add money into math early on, you really, that often brings that whole mathematics into focus. If you add compound interest, into your mathematics curriculum, again, students pretty quickly understand math better. So, my own bias would be to look at it as an essential skill, as you suggest, Senator, and we committed to come back next month actually and take a look at this. So on the finance side, on the civic side, it's more, I would say just briefly, it's more complicated by the fact that I've reviewed the standards. If you've looked at our social science standards, my concern there is a concern we've been having with all our standards, but in particular this area is we have too many, and we've got to figure out what is really essential, because we know the results of our civics education are far too many students graduate not really knowing very much about civics. And we've got to change that. And I think that report highlighted it. We've got to figure out, as a board, what is really important for all students to know about democracy and you know the system, so that we really have a literate population in the civics area, which is a real problem right now.
All right.
So
I think we'll be hearing some more on that. Go ahead. That's just a follow-up comment, and I'll be finished with that line. I appreciate your responses. I do think it's critical, and I also appreciate having worked on Senator Bonamici and others on other issues regarding industry. Those are certainly true, but the biggest protection against that is an educated citizenry. And so it's one thing to regulate, but other people to know, you know, how things work, and it's really a tandem operation. Is a proper regulation of the financial industry and the ability to provide products, and a citizenry who understands how it works. So we'll look forward to working on those issues. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I appreciate the comment about putting money into math skills. I noticed my daughter took on to math a lot quicker when we started talking about allowance and buying skateboards. So, Commissioner Poyas, if I could segue into your presentation here. We've been talking about the diploma requirements, and I realize you have a presentation, but how does that change your world by raising the bar on our high school graduates?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Cam Preuss, I am the Commissioner of Community Colleges, as well as the Director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Superintendent Castillo indicated, we have been working collaboratively on this, as you call, the raising of the bar for the high school diploma, and having ongoing conversations with faculty and administrators that what is that level going to mean for a high school student that comes to the community college. Could we take that new diploma and say it tells us enough about the student so that additional testing isn't necessary? That would be a plus for the student. Is certainly this committee is likely aware of a lot of the dual credit work that already goes on between community colleges and high schools, where students are earning college credit while they're in high school, while they know that that bar is higher than it is for what they need for high school because it's collegiate level work. We are currently in that work and doing and another piece to talk to you about other ways in which students can demonstrate that they have met the essential skills that are a part of the diploma is work that is ongoing between our two departments. I hope that's responsive.
I think that's excellent.
Okay. Well, I want to, being last provides me with not having to be redundant, which you'll appreciate. So I'll just say try to link back to comments that were made by Chair Weiss and Superintendent Castillo. The the legislative priorities for the department really center around the goal of educational attainment and the 40-40-20. And we see ourselves as having a major responsibility for that middle 40. And that middle 40 is defined as a professional certification or an associate's degree. And what in working with the Post-Secondary Quality Ed Commission, Oregon has about 33% of its population that has had some college, which is better than the national average. But we have less than the national average of individuals with an associate's degree. So we are really concentrating on ways in which we can endorse or certificate that learning for Oregonians. And just to remind you about what is that middle 40, or what we also refer to as a middle skill job, you know, your community colleges produce most of your police officers, your medical emergency technicians, your firemen. They also produce most of the nurses in the state. Most allied health technicians come from community colleges. So those are the kinds of middle skill jobs I'm talking about that are in that middle 40. And we, as Duncan said, we need to continue our investment and continue to expand our capacity. And we find ourselves in what I might refer to as a perfect storm, in that Oregon's community college enrollment this fall went up 10.5% across the state. It was at a high of over 20% in Central Oregon, but overall 10.5%. Last year, our enrollment increased by 3.4% across the full year. Now, I will tell you that I don't expect that 10.5% to stick. Fall term is historically, across almost all education or post-secondary institutions, the high water mark, and students will, for life reasons, or grade reasons, or financial reasons, not return to finish out that year. But I expect that we will have a higher enrollment growth than we had last year. And that's because of our economic situation. We also have the blessing, if you will, of increased financial aid until it ran out at the end of November. So far since the December 1st, which was the cutoff date, there's no more financial aid available. More than 2,000 students have applied, and more than 90% of them were applying from a community college. So we find, as I said, find ourselves in a perfect storm where more students are wanting access to the community college, many of them will find it a difficult task to afford because there is not financial aid. So our priorities are around holding on to the resource that is dedicated to from the general fund to the community college support fund. Also, there are three capital construction projects that are in the governor's budget that we're going to work hard to make sure they are funded. The Chair Weiss spoke to you about the Oregon's Career Readiness Certificate. We're in the process of working with two national firms or experts, and certain there are about 20 other states, most of them, as Duncan said, east of the Mississippi, who have adopted a career readiness certificate. That certificate is a way to both assess and certificate, if you will, the knowledge and skill an individual has based on what employers nationally have said are required for certain kinds of job families or occupations. And we're following the Olympic model. We're intending to have a bronze, silver, and gold level of certification, where if you had a gold certificate, you would have the knowledge and skill, basic knowledge and skill, to do 80% of the jobs in Oregon and also across the nation. That means that we're working with employers as they articulate what it is, what's the level of skill that's necessary, and then in turn communicate that to high school students, adults who have a job and want to move up in that job, or for adults who've lost their job as a way for them to perhaps, if they don't feel that they can invest in a community college education, they can be assessed and find what level of skill they have and then learn what jobs they can get with that level of skill. We have paired with that an online curriculum module that will help an individual move from, let's say, a bronze level to a silver level. They can do that. It's self-paced, and then they can reassess or retest, if you will, to see if they have increased their skill. We have about 200 employers right now who are champions for the CRC. It is just in the demonstration stage. We have used federal dollars to begin this demonstration and are hopeful that you'll see the merits of this and fund it in as requested in the governor's budget. The last funding piece I'd like to talk to you about is career and technical education. There's an investment in the governor's budget to expand career and technical education in the community colleges, primarily through outreach to high schools. You probably recognize that many high schools have either certainly curtailed or ceased their offerings of career and technical education, because just as in high schools and in community colleges, they are the most expensive programs we offer. So the governor has asked the community colleges to ramp up the work that they do with high schools in order to not transfer them, but to better partner with high schools so that career and technical education can again be a part of what's offered there. Briefly, other issues of interest. As my introduction, I have responsibility for federal workforce programs in the state, so I'm paying very close attention to the federal stimulus. Right now, it looks like the state could receive, if the House package that was produced last Thursday or Friday actually comes to fruition, nearly $30 million in additional job training dollars, which is sorely needed now. Every week, my office receives what are called WARN notices. Not sure if you're familiar with those, but if a company has more than 50 employees and intends to lay off a portion of those, they are required by federal law to alert an office, and that is my office, and we then move with local service providers to be on site to talk to the workers as well as to the management about what services are available to be reemployed or to receive unemployment insurance. So we're pleased with that. We're also doing a lot of work with the employment department to discern where what we're calling the shovel-ready workforce is. All the resources that is likely to come from federal stimulus that's going to be requiring workers, we feel we have information that will help across the state, whether it's ODOT or it's housing or it's a local community that has resources to do curbs, roads, you name it. We believe that we have information in the Employment Department database to tell them where there are workers that could be qualified to fill those jobs and make that match much more seamlessly and, I won't say effortlessly, but more efficiently than we have in the past. I'll leave it with that and certainly take any questions that you might have.
Okay. Commissioner, I do have one question, and that is, I guess pretty broad, but down the road here in this committee, we're going to be looking at consolidation proposals in the university system. But I was intrigued as I was looking at this by something that's already in existence, and that is through Oregon State, community college credits mm-hmm. are already in the Oregon State system. Can you tell me how that works and mm-hmm. how we can, you know, what the benefits are? I mean, aside from the obvious, I mean, I would assume there's some savings there, and I assume it's easier for students and for you.
Chair Haas, I think you've answered your own question.
Thank
yes.
You. Yeah, okay.
No, but I'll elaborate as well. Oregon State University has now agreements with all 17 community colleges around something they call a dual program. It's not dual enrollment in the way we think, or dual credit in the way that we think about it at high schools, although it could be. But the dual enrollment program really allows, personified by Lynn Benton, and Senator Morse could probably read you chapter and verse about how this happens, but there is one application, there's one financial aid application. The offerings transfer back and forth, so a student at Lynn Benton could be enrolled full-time at Lynn Benton, but paying for one or two courses at Oregon State, and it all goes on one transcript. The faculty between those two institutions have worked for a number of years to make this seamless. I'm not sure there is, but I know that last session there was actually a bus that transported students between the two institutions. So that's really the creme de la creme, if you will, of these dual program arrangements. But in the others, Oregon State has worked to ensure that students at any community college are well advised and aware of what credits are necessary for certain majors. But there is also something called a university center that the university system uses, and it's either it's any of the universities, actually, but the largest proponent of this and deliverer is actually Eastern, has a university center in at Southwestern Oregon Community College, at Blue Mountain, at Treasure Valley, at other places around the state, so that a student can also be at the community college campus, be advised about four-year baccalaureate work, and take that work at the community colleges and have it count for beyond the associate degree.
Well, I was just wondering, is the Oregon State, is there a template that, you know, the University of Oregon can do that? Is this going to spread, or is it just this one time?
Chair Haas, I'm afraid I can't answer. I don't know of programs for I don't know of other universities who have programs to replicate what Oregon State has done. But I do know that they have a vital and robust relationship with Lane Community College in their community.
Mr. Chair, in Portland State has very robust relationships with the three community colleges in the area, and I think actually goes to Chemeketas, if I'm not mistaken. But the other point I would make, Cam's explanation, your question, really, I think, is a perfect presentation of what the governor's called the enterprise. I mean, increasingly we're seeing the lines blur between high school, community college, and higher ed, and students are moving back and forth. And our policy challenge is, how do you make that easy and very workable? President Ed Ray meets regularly with the community college president, all the superintendents in that Mid-Willamette area, and they have really done remarkable work. And I'm sure Senator Morris is aware
of
blurring those lines, and from the student perspective, so they can just move all the way through.
I think that's the direction of seamlessness.
Yes.
Any questions for Commissioner Senator Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just comment in a very positive way about the role of community colleges in these articulation dual agreement enrollment agreements. I was visiting with a chair of a division at Oregon State University, and his comment was that and it was specific to math, in the area of math instruction, that it was his judgment that students get a better education at the community college level than they do at the university level. The size of the class, more personalized instruction, and so that students coming out of the community college then going into upper division do better and are better prepared. So the system is working, and it's working well.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. Do you have some numbers on your wait list for nursing and allied health programs, and have you given much thought into how we reduce? I mean, one of the biggest problems to get people to teach nursing is salary, clearly. And so have you given any thought into how we remedy that situation? I've got some of my own thoughts, but I want to hear yours.
It's actually a conversation Cam brought to the board last Friday, so Cam might want to, but I'd love to hear, I think we both would love to hear your thoughts, but Cam, you
want. Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, my number may not be up to date, but a month and a half ago, the number was there are 4 qualified students for every nursing slot.
Not what I thought. Okay.
And certainly there's any number of complicators in why that wait list is so long. And one of them is certainly nursing faculty and both their preparation, though salary and wage or compensation, but we simply don't have enough. We have more retiring than we have to take their place. And it has been prioritized by the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute as that place. I'm seeing a nod because there was a presentation last week to a Senate committee on the work that needs to be done around increasing the number of health educators.
Well, you know, I'm just a simple country boy, and I don't know a lot, but it seemed to me that maybe if we had, obviously one of the problems is you just throw more money into the salary formula, and you kind of exacerbate the problem. I was wondering if it would be possible to do some targeted funding to the high-end programs. Clearly, with some benchmarks they would have to meet as far as the product they're turning out. It takes it outside the formula. I understand
right.
But in some cases, that may be the only way we can get to remedy. Comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, we have talked about that as a board. The priority, one of the responsibilities, which I assume you're aware, but maybe not, is of the board and community colleges, is we're responsible for the distribution formula. So you
right.
send us a budget. And the priority of the last, in this period, this 6-year period we're in, under Cam's terrific leadership, has been to equalize funding. And the reason, I think we're all aware of the controversies there, and we're happy to go through this, but just like in K-12, when Measure 5 was adopted, we've actually gone a lot slower in the community college, but we're committed to having a standard dollar per student across the state. So that's been the priority. But once that's done, Cam and others have talked about the idea of giving additional weights to specific professional technical program areas of high priority to the state, because you are absolutely right that some of those programs just cost more. Now, the other part of it is that we need to ask the employers to contribute. And in the healthcare field, they are. I mean, they're putting in additional resources, and there may be ways to help there. But as we think about the future and the funding formulas, I think really addressing all the professional technical areas and really asking, you know, is that formula going to work for those more expensive programs? I would point out in the higher ed case where they're funding the state board model does give additional weights to engineering and the more expensive programs. We don't do that in the community colleges, but we put as a priority, I think, first to get equalization in place and then potentially look at that.
Mr. Chair, I understand the politics of that. I've been here long enough to know that, what it comes down to is, we got a lot of kids coming out of school, and we have some very, very good-paying jobs out there.
Mm-hmm.
That you want to talk about your graduation requirements of math and science. I mean, my God, that makes that so relevant. It's beyond
mm-hmm.
belief. And
mm-hmm.
and if there's something we can do systemically to enhance the ability of kids to get into a discipline that they have a desire to, and we don't have capacity for, I think that's got to be a high priority.
Good.
All right.
Well, we very much appreciate the higher echelon of our educational system coming for us. We'll be seeing you again in all things education-wise, including year-round education coming up in a few weeks.
That's a great idea. Let's talk about that.
Thank you, Senator.
All. I'm going to close the informational meeting, and from the biggest, broadest overview of education, we are going to focus in on some of the tiniest slice of education. I'd like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bills 41 and 69 and a work session on Senate Bills 41 and 69. Why don't we start with 41.
Mr. Chair, would you like to provide us a quick summary?
Senate Bill 41 removes the sunset on pilot education service districts. It renames these districts as alternative education service districts. It provides a process for any ESD to organize as an alternative education service district. It specifies the term of office for those directors, provides for a recall of elected directors, and it specifies quorum requirements and staggering of terms for directors. In addition to the staff measure summary you have before you, a statement indicating that there's a minimal fiscal impact. You also have some suggested language and thoughts from the Department of Education, which presumably they would love to speak to, as well as the bill, and it repeals pieces of the original pilot ESD bill, which is HB 3184, so you have that up here, as well as Senate Bill 755, which changed some of the original pilot ESD bill, so just so you can see the provisions that we're getting rid of, but it's all part of the sunset process.
Okay. We have someone from the department, Morgan Allen, can come up and give us perspective, overview, and what this seeks to do.
Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen, Superintendent's Office at the Oregon Department of Education, and this is not our bill. So I come here in the spirit of offering friendly suggestions, and I mean, we're neutral on this bill, but a couple things that both myself and Jan McComb, who staffs the State Board of Education, and Cindy Hunt at our agency reviewed this bill. And as you know, the bill allows all 20 ESDs, so besides the three ESDs, Northwest Regional, Willamette, and High Desert, that became quote-unquote pilot ESDs, it basically would allow the other 17 ESDs, if they so chose, to undergo a process to enter into that alternative governance model where the boards are elected by the component school districts, and then that board elected by the component school districts elects the rest of the board. So five people elected by the component school districts, and those five people then elect four more for a total of nine members of their boards of directors. A couple things, and I say these things in the spirit of trying to find some solutions to these. Ozzie Rose and I had a good discussion about this earlier today, and there's a couple things that we were concerned about specifically in the bill. If you read starting on page four, the bill would actually require the State Board of Education to hold public hearings in the actual ESDs if they decided to go through this process. So conceivably, you could have some real scheduling issues if, for example, the Malheur ESD decided they wanted to undergo this process, and we had to set up a one-day special State Board of Education hearing in, say, Jordan Valley, and getting the board members out there, you know, with their schedules. There's also, we have submitted an indeterminate fiscal impact to the agency on this bill.
Is that Section 8?
Let me pull the bill. I believe it starts on the bottom of, or on page 4. Let's see here.
8B?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's starting on line 32, page 4, is where it starts getting into. And then section 9, line 42, talks about public hearings that the State Board of Education shall be hold. So essentially what you could have to have is the State Board of Education having potentially 17 hearings. It's not likely that all 17 ESDs might want to undergo this governance change. But if you did that, we submitted a fiscal with really three alternatives based on the ways the bill's written today, and I think Mr. Rose and I will probably want to work on the side to sort of sort this out. But you could conceivably have the entire State Board of Education go out, and because you have to have a quorum, so you're going to have at least four members. So there's travel expenses. So even assuming if we absorb the staffing, we use our current State Board staffing, and we get free facilities, say at the ESD, to hold the public hearing, there's still a cost associated with travel, mileage, setting up the hearing, doing the public notice, hotels, meals, et cetera, for the board members. So we sort of said that could cost probably about $5,000 for a one-day hearing. A second alternative model would be the board could delegate that to a hearings officer. We could hire a hearings officer. That would cost about probably $2,500 for a hearings officer to go out and listen to the community and the state and the local school districts talk about why they want to do this. Because ultimately, one thing I failed to mention, ultimately the bill gives the State Board of Education the ability to up or down this model. So the local school boards petition the state board and say, we want to make this change. The board goes and holds a public hearing, and then ultimately the board decides yay or nay based on what they hear ostensibly at that public hearing.
So what I'm hearing between the lines is you don't want to be the elections department of ESD.
Well, I think that's a good question. I talked to the board chair about this, and he's interested in hearing more, which is why I think Mr. Rose and I need to probably talk on the side a little bit. And then the third option would be they could delegate it to staff, and we could have existing staff set up and hold these hearings. But the way the bill is constructed right now, they have to hold the hearing in the ESD, and I have a color map here to sort of illustrate where all the ESDs are and where conceivably we'd have to hold these board hearings. So I think those are fixes that are easy to achieve if we just sit down and talk a little bit.
Okay. Mr. Rose,
together.
Do you need to say something for the record on behalf of ESDs on this bill?
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Senator Bruce?
Because I did work on this bill. But clearly that wasn't our intent. I wanted to leave it open-ended. Quite honestly, I don't think an ESD in the foreseeable future is necessarily going to opt for this model simply because I don't think it's been in operation long enough to prove whether it's a successful model yet or not. So, it wasn't our intention ever to burden the department with all of this stuff. So, we might even. I'll talk to you guys afterwards about it. But I don't want to create another whole bureaucratic nightmare we've got to go through, or put in statute just for something that might or might not happen. We created the original ones, and at some point, if an ESD wanted to become one, we could say you are it. So it may be best to revert that decision back to the Legislative Assembly. Upon a request of an ESD, because, every 2 years is often enough for somebody to look at this sort of thing. So,
and then, Mr. Chair, just a closing comment, and I think I shared these with the committee administrator, and I have copies of them if you need them, but I submitted a one-page with a couple suggested amendments in addition to the things I talked about. And essentially, you can read that on your own time for expediency's sake, but essentially the amendments we put together do accomplish two things. Number one, they make sure it's clear that these ESD boards and these alternative education service districts have ongoing authority to conduct the elections. It sets up the process to have the first election, but then as board members expire and you need to have new board members, it's not clear that they have ongoing authority to keep replacing those members. And the second one, there's some confusing language on page 5 about electors, and so we want to just clarify that, and we think that tightens up the qualifications. Essentially, there's a section in there where it talks about they need to get an indeterminate amount of quote-unquote electors, which is language that you'd see for like a general election where the whole public it's a public vote of registered voters rather than sort of an internal election process. So we've got some clarifications to sort of tighten down those qualifications in addition to the other things I've mentioned. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any more questions, Morgan Allen?
Okay.
Senator
Bonavici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a sort of big picture question that will help maybe put this in context, at least for me. What are the advantages of being an alternative education service district, and is it likely that most of the ESDs will want to do that, or are there not enough advantages for them to want to ask to do that?
Senator Haas and Senator Bonamici, if it's all right, I would defer to my colleague, Mr. Oziros, who represents the ESDs. Again, this is not an agency bill, and I'm not familiar with the sort of pros and cons of ESDs. Senator Cruz was involved in the original legislation in 2005, so if it's all right, I don't want to weasel.
Right.
I will defer.
Thank you.
I will defer to my colleagues.
Weasel, so. Defer. It's a fine line.
It was actually Jim Sager's fault. So.
All right. Clearly, there's going to be some amendments coming, and I didn't mean to infer that this was your bill, Mr. Allen. So we were going to move then to Senate Bill 69, if you wouldn't mind staying there, because I know this is the department's bill.
Sure.
And Dana, can you give us a breakdown on
this? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 69 requires pilot education service districts to contract with a public or private entity to conduct the election of their directors. It prohibits the pilot ESDs from contracting with the component school district for those elections. It declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2009.
Okay. Mr. Allen, could you give us the overview of this one and why this is needed?
Sure. Again, for the record, Chair Hassan, members of the committee, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. And this also ties in, it's very similar to the issue of the pilot ESDs, but this is like a 5 or 6 levels down. It's a sub issue of pilot ESDs. Essentially, when the original pilot ESD legislation was created in 2005, it did not specify who conducts the ongoing election. So as I described earlier, the component school districts get together and vote and select 5 members, and then those 5 members select 4 members based on some criteria laid out in statute. And in the absence of that specific electoral process, on a volunteer basis, staff at the Oregon Department of Education have essentially been acting as an elections division for these pilot ESDs. We've helped them tally the votes, and I believe we've also helped deal with some of the notice and some of the other little technical aspects of these elections. And as we began the session, Cindy Hunt, our legal affairs coordinator, who many of you remember from Legislative Council, and I were trying to look for things where we thought we could maybe tighten some things up in statute and clarify things to help other people out. And so essentially all Senate Bill 69 does, it clarifies that these ESDs have the authority to conduct their own elections as they see fit. Again, there's no formal process in statute, and this bill will allow them to do that. So, again, we're not really elections experts, and we probably shouldn't be getting involved in the elections at these ESDs. So our bill really just, if you go to the language on the front page of the bill is all cleanup stuff, I believe, from Legislative Council, just sort of your standard bringing the definitions up to date. And the real change occurs on page 2, lines 5, 6, and 7, and where we describe a pilot education service shall contract with a public or private entity to conduct any election. And essentially what we're envisioning is that these ESDs, we're giving them clarity and authority and statute if they want to hire a CPA or attorney, or if they want to go to their local county elections clerk and have them oversee these vote counting processes, that they could do that. Again, I've talked to Mr. Ozzie Rose about this bill as well. I think on line 5, we may look for a minor amendment to change that to a may, and ultimately our goal would be that I think we could fold in this concept into Senate Bill 41. So ideally we could come back to you with amendments to Senate Bill 41 that would satisfy sort of the technical friendly amendments I was describing earlier that relate to the state board and then address our issue right here. So again, our intention is only to sort of give clarity to the statute that the ESDs can sort of conduct their electoral business as they see fit. And I think we could come up with one amendment that would accomplish all of that. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Questions? Senator Cruz.
I think we're overcomplicating it, but quite honestly, I clearly I'm not comfortable with the private entity. I'm just wondering, Morgan, why the ESD has a superintendent. He runs the ESD. I mean, this is a different election. This is the school districts within this portion of the ESD getting together and choosing a representative. It's not an election. It's kind of, you know, so really all you need is somebody to tabulate the choices that were made. So why can't the superintendent just gather the data, seat the board, that board selects their other 4, because there are categories and criteria there and recommendations made, and then once that's all seated, the superintendent of the ESD reports it to you so you know what's there and we're done. Isn't that pretty simple?
Chair Hass, Senator Cruz, I think that could be done under current construct right now. Again, what's really happening is the department is sort of stepping in on a volunteer basis. I think what's happening is that, and I can't speak for the ESDs, but talking to Maureen Casey, the superintendent of Willamette ESD, is essentially I think sort of how this happened and how we sort of volunteered to do this was that I think some of the superintendents may have felt like they needed to have sort of an outside party, a third party, actually. And we're not talking about a lot of votes. We're talking about the component school districts, so 25 votes, 40 votes, 50 votes. We're not talking about a lot of votes here, but that somebody else doesn't have their hand in the cookie jar, that there's a third party looking at those votes, which is why we thought, you know, maybe the best people to do that would be a CPA or an attorney or a local county elections clerk. Right now, there's no direction in statute for the department to do that for the pilot ESDs. So potentially that could become an issue down the road, which is why we thought if we put it in statute, give them the option of finding an entity that they deem trustworthy or that their community might deem trustworthy, that then that whole issue of vote counting, albeit a very small number of votes, is not it is totally transparent for those ESDs, and their communities can feel like it's being handled appropriately.
I understand that, and when we put this together, I thought the ESDs could handle it themselves, and what I'm hearing from you is that because they're not told to, they don't necessarily feel comfortable doing it. So maybe what we just need to do is say, this is your responsibility, do it. And no more complicated than that. Then they have the assurance that that's what we actually meant for them to do. I'm not quite sure I know of an ESD board that that their superintendent doesn't have a good relationship with. And like you say, this is well. And in some of these elections, we're dealing with even smaller numbers than that. I think the Northwest ESD, I think, doesn't Beaverton have two people on that board, so there's one school district there. So, you know, I understand what you're trying to do, and I appreciate that, but let's just make this simple and go with the specific language we intended when we did this originally. I think that would probably satisfy everybody. So when you go to your work group.
Yeah. And just, I think whenever you see the words contracting with a private entity with respect to an election, it raises the hackles of people in government, you know. In all practical purposes, maybe it shouldn't, but it does.
Yeah.
And I think it would be a good idea to combine these fixes into one piece of legislation.
Okay.
We'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions or comments on either of these two bills? If not, then we are adjourned.
Well done.
One under your belt.